I'm Nish Weiseth.
I'm Amy Sullivan, and this is Impolite Company, a show where we talk about the tricky subjects polite people are supposed to avoid, especially religion and politics. This week's show is something of an advice episode in that we're going to take up a few situations that journalists sometimes have trouble handling in one instance, and that Christian churches can often mishandle in another. We'll discuss first a story that quickly swept through social media last week regarding a religious sect, some people would call it a cult, in Pennsylvania, that held a ceremony to which parishioners brought their firearms to be blessed. It's a useful illustration of the ways that decisions about how to cover religion stories can lead to inaccurate portrayals and can exacerbate tensions.
We'll also talk about something that may be very familiar to some listeners, the practice by some Christian churches of holding their own celebrations of Jewish holidays, particularly Passover, and we were surprised to learn recently, Purim. Amy called up Mark Oppenheimer, a longtime religion reporter and co-host of the Tablet magazine podcast Unorthodox, to have him explain why Christian seders are problematic and can lack context. And then she and I discussed the issue in slightly less diplomatic terms.
But first, we have some listeners to thank. As we announced in our last episode, you can now become a supporter of Impolite Company through our Patreon page. We've been bowled over by the patrons who have signed up in just the first week, and we want to especially thank Forrest Dillaway and Karen Weiseth for their generous backing. If you haven't checked out our Patreon page yet, please follow the link in the episode notes in your podcast app of choice, and consider becoming a monthly patron of the show. We'd love to have your support. Okay, moving on. Ever since Nish left Twitter, we kick off our show every week with 3 minutes of Nish, wherein she gets to rage about whatever it is she would have gotten out of her system if she was still unloading her thoughts 280 characters at a time. Last week, she kindly offered up her 3 minutes to me, but she's back this week, and I can't wait to hear what she has to say.
This week, my rant is about Oprah. Oh, please calm down. I'm not criticizing Oprah. We all know she's a sovereign queen who reigns over us with her book clubs and favorite things. No, I have something to say about how too many people are talking about Oprah running for president. Too many people are talking about it like it's an idea that we should consider. Too many people are talking about it like we should really seriously take a look at this option. And too many people are talking about Oprah like she's the best hope for the Democratic Party. No. No, 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 no. Stop it. We do not need another celebrity with no relevant experience running for office. Not to mention that she has said multiple times that she's not running. Not running. Not going to happen. Not giving. Stop giving it airtime and coverage in national media outlets like it's going to happen. Oprah is not running for president, and Oprah should not run for president. She is a wonderful, warm, generous, brilliant woman who has amazing experience running a media empire that she built herself. She is a national treasure. But what she doesn't have is any experience on writing laws, running any form of government, intricate knowledge of policy development, experience with negotiating with foreign leaders of government. The last thing we need is another person with a wildly popular name running for office and no relevant experience. The United States government is not a business. It is a government. We should find someone who could run the government like a well-run government. Look, I get it. After Trump, it'd be really easy to say, well, anything is game now. No, no, no. We cannot let the anomaly become the norm. After Trump, it would be really easy to say, we need to find someone with amazing charisma and popularity. Yes, true. But you also need to find someone who's qualified to do the job. We want both. Don't sacrifice one for the other. Celebrities as politicians does not serve us well. So stop it. Stop it with Oprah. Stop it with The Rock. Stop it with any other magazine cover celebrity with a media brand empire. Stop it. Get serious. Stop being stupid. The stakes are too freaking high. Knock it off.
Let's move on to our first topic. Odds are you saw photos last week of a, quote, church, unquote, in Pennsylvania holding a ceremony to bless congregants' guns. They included pictures of people wearing crowns made of bullets, and many dressed in wedding attire embracing their firearms. You may have even retweeted or shared the photos. Tens of thousands of people did. And it's easy to see why. The images were startling, even disturbing. And to many people, they were a confirmation of religious conservatism run amok. Evangelicals have really done it now. They're literally worshiping guns inside their churches. Except that it wasn't a church, and these weren't evangelicals. The photos were from the World Peace and Unification Sanctuary, which is an offshoot of the Unification Church. That's a sect that started with Christian roots, but became really a cult of personality around the late Reverend Sun Myung Moon. The people who belong to this sect are sometimes pejoratively referred to as Moonies, so you may have heard them that way. Reverend Moon preached that he was the second coming of Christ, and he wrote his own extra-biblical scripture. Now, as people who have listened to our podcast know, we have very strong thoughts about conservative evangelicals and what we see as their unhealthy embrace of not only gun culture, but of theology that has been somewhat warped to provide justification for Christians embracing guns and a proliferation of guns. However, I kind of fought a battle all last week on social media over this, because as soon as I saw the AP photos come out and the caption was labeled something about how this was a ceremony that had taken place at a Pennsylvania church, and it was just that word church, nothing about it with the exact title of the place or any indication that it was anything other than your standard Christian Protestant church, I knew that this was going to be clickbait, retweet bait, whatever you want to call it, and that it would end up muddying, which is all what is already a very difficult and complicated conversation, which is about Christians and guns and evangelicals and guns. And so I led kind of not a one-woman crusade. There were a couple of other people who joined me on this.
You're fighting the good fight, though.
But I first was trying to just encourage people to not retweet or to provide some context, and going after some colleagues I know who were sharing it and saying, "Oh my God, can you believe these people have really done it now?" And then realized that the most effective way to deal with this is to go straight to the source. In the future, I will just contact the media outlet that puts out the initial tweet. And in fact, AP did change their caption. So now if you see it online, it makes very clear that this is a ceremony at the World Peace and Unification Sanctuary, which does not, I don't think, scan as, oh, just another evangelical church, of course. But by the time they changed that caption, it was gone. It had gone out via basically every major news outlet. All the major broadcast channels had tweeted it out. New York Times, Washington Post, all of the places.
It had taken on a life of its own.
Exactly. And for me, it became what's kind of a pet peeve of mine, which is there are enough real examples of religious extremism to use. I do not think it helps the debate to muddy things by pulling in others and painting them as part of evangelicalism. And I heard from a lot of people who said, what's the difference? Evangelicals are still screwed up when it comes to guns. And, you know, we can engage on that. But to me, it was very similar to what we saw a few years ago, when you may remember there was a supposed pastor down in Florida who was threatening to burn the Quran.
Oh, burning the Quran. Yeah, yeah.
Every news network sent cameras down there to watch this guy. Turned out
it was wall-to-wall coverage. It was wall-to-wall.
Ridiculous. Yes. He was very media savvy because he did not have a church. He did not have supporters. He was just a dude who called himself a pastor and was burning Qurans. And yet, the way it was covered very much gave the impression that there was this corner of evangelicalism that was so enraptured with Islamophobia that they would go around taunting Muslims by burning their holy scripture. And, you know, we can talk about Islamophobia within evangelical circles, but that is not the way to do it.
Yeah. For me, it just goes to show why shows like ours, shows like, and like good religion reporters are so needed. because these conversations require a lot of context, they require a lot of nuance, they require a lot of depth, and they require accurate information, which just goes to show that every like newsroom has to have a very well-versed religion reporter who really is like an expert enough to know the differentiation to not report falsely on some of this stuff. Because what you were saying, like it makes some of these conversations, like we can't have a real conversation about evangelicalism and guns when this example of these Moonies, I guess is what they're called, are used as a legitimate kind of example in the debate as a, you know, reason why evangelicals should be, you know, chided for their gun support, whatever. Like, no, like they're an outlier. They're not actually, you know, a Christian denomination. They're not like there's this nuance and depth that's required here in order for us to have really serious conversations. Like, we're not going to be able to do it.
It just undercuts your credibility.
My gosh.
And they can say, well, that wasn't us.
Right.
So yeah. Next.
Yeah. And it just, but what that does and what we're seeing now, especially because of social media, because right, like these tweets, I mean, I wasn't on Twitter. You're saying it was on Twitter. So there were like retweets and everything else. But I mean, I saw it on Facebook too. Like my Facebook feed was filled with it. And social media is, it drives some of these false narratives so fast. And you can't turn it around. Like you literally cannot turn it around. All of a sudden it turns into this like, you know, freighter that like has just taken off, and there's no backing this train up at all. And before you know it, like it has created a situation in which you can't actually have a more nuanced conversation because the information is false.
Well, and it's also in the context of fake news and the way in which that term and that concept has just really invaded a lot of people's minds. And, you know, in this case, it wasn't even false. It lacked context and therefore was very easy to have people jump to their preconceived ideas about churches and guns.
Yep. And what that does ultimately to civil discourse is makes it even worse. Like these are the types of things that are driving the wedges further apart, right? Because we can't have a conversation on guns, immigration, abortion, healthcare, like you name it, literally any policy issue. We can't have a legitimate full conversation about how to come together and enact change or find compromise if we are not operating with the same basis of fact. And the lack of facts, like true facts, is like killing our discourse. And while what you were saying, it's not that this was a false story, it just wasn't the whole story. And in order to have really good conversations about what to do about some of these things, we have to start operating with a full set of facts, and certainly not with lies or with false reporting or with fake news or with, you know, any of those other things. So I don't know. It just goes to show, honestly, in some ways, how damaging the speed of social media can be in our dissemination of information, and how you like once it's out there and once it catches fire and it takes off, like there's just, you can't turn it around. You can't bring it back. you can't. And it, I mean, people can issue retractions and they can, you know, delete tweets. And but by that point, it's gone, you know, like 23,000 retweets or something. And you just like, what do you do? People have retweeted it, assuming that it's fact.
Well, it then becomes fact for them.
That's right. That's exactly right. And again, it becomes a definer and a marker in a conversation that should not, like, that thing should not be a definer and a marker in that conversation. And, we're screwed.
I guarantee you, the next time I go and give a talk about evangelicals, and I talk about guns because I always bring up guns as one of the problematic issues, somebody is going to say, well, what about that crazy church ceremony where they were blessing their guns? And that will already be part of their narrative. And yes, I'll correct it, but that's always the hard work, and it never overcomes the initial misconception because it matches so closely what they want to think, what many people want to think.
That's right. These sorts of stories that are crazy outliers that don't always have like the full information in some ways can already affirm someone's bias. And so it becomes even harder to deconstruct for someone, right? Like what you were saying, you're like, I'll always correct it. But that person already has like a narrative built in their head. And this just kind of like added another brick onto it. And so, which just made it stronger and harder to deconstruct. And so these sorts of things are just, they're killing us, Amy. They're killing us.
Well, as you say, we need better religion coverage and we need more religion coverage, because I saw an item about this about a week or so before it actually happened. And as you know, I can be a little cynical about the state of evangelicalism today. But my immediate thought was like, seriously? And all I had to do was click and follow through the link to see, oh, yeah, that's not
actually.
Those are the Moonies.
Right.
Yes. Which I'm not supposed to say. It's the World Evangelical or Unification Church, but and not even that. It's an offshoot. Little tangent here, which I think you will enjoy. After Reverend Moon died, there were lots of power battles for control. And two of his sons ended up like breaking off. And one of them, by the way, owns a gun company. So, there's a reason why this particular sect is a little crazy about guns. And I should note, like, Reverend Moon had his own political involvement and lots of problems there. So we can talk about that, but that is not what people were getting upset about. They were assuming this fell into their idea of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, everybody, Franklin Graham, that evangelicalism. But one of the Moon sons, who is head of this particular sect, turns out he went to Harvard Divinity School and got his master's in theological studies, as did I. And that is not what I would have guessed as his background.
Hang on. Okay. Hang on. Pause.
Yeah.
The guy who leads this group that was blessing AR-15s went to Harvard Divinity School? Is that what you're telling me?
Yep. Possibly at the same time I was there. Trying to figure out the chronology here. But yeah.
Like, how does that happen? How does that happen? How does someone with a Harvard Divinity degree, does he have a degree? Did he graduate? Do we know?
Yeah, it's an ecumenical school, Nish.
I mean, I know it's an ecumenical
real
school.
Christians don't consider it real religious training.
But it's Harvard. it's Harvard. How do you go to Harvard?
Pat Robertson went to Yale.
That's true. Oh, man.
I know.
I'm sorry.
Anyway, that deflated my balloon a little bit when I read that.
Wearing that Harvard sweatshirt with just a little bit less
proud now.
But
what if that had been in the caption?
Right.
Like, religious community led by Harvard graduate. Then that would have totally screwed up the perceptions.
Yeah, that's right.
Liberals who saw it.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, this instance, it just goes to show that the lack of nuance and depth and context, and really the full story, which creates a sense of fake news. Now, there is actually fake news, a thing that is fake news that we are up against as a country, for sure. But this sort of thing and the way these stories are couched with this lack of context is also deeply problematic on the left. Like, this is not just something that is happening on the right in a pro-Trump America. It's something that the left has to be mindful of too. And like, you can't, I mean, I don't know. Like, I can understand maybe some of the arguments of like, we got to fight fire with fire, right? It's all about the narrative and it's about the message. And like, is that really what you want to be about?
Yeah,
like,
but there is so much material that is
right.
Real.
Why do you have to, like, I don't want to say like stretch the truth, but like take out some of the context to really give the whole story when there's other things that.
Yeah, you don't need this as your data point. You've got data points.
A whole plethora.
We can give you data points.
We have all the data points. But yeah, it's gosh, it's really
welcome to my life's work.
Amy fighting the man of misinformation. One article at a time. Good job. Godspeed. That's what I have to say. Okay, let's move on. For our second topic this week, guys, we need to talk about religious and cultural appropriation.
Pull up a chair.
we've got some words to say. For some, it may seem a little weird to talk about this now in March, but these conversations usually come up around Halloween and how some costumes are offensive and, you know, that sort of thing. But this is actually the time of year when the Jewish holidays of Purim and Passover fall on the calendar. And lately, we have noticed a trend. Progressive and conservative evangelical Christians alike have taken a keen interest in these traditional holidays and have decided to start practicing them on their own outside of Jewish context and tradition. Churches are throwing Purim parties and small group leaders are holding seders. What in the hell is happening? So to answer this question and give us some context, Amy, you interviewed Mark Oppenheimer, an award-winning reporter, a former columnist for the New York Times. He's a religion scholar who's taught at Yale, Stanford, and NYU, and he's now the host of a popular podcast called Unorthodox, and it's produced by Tablet Magazine. But most importantly, for the context of this discussion, Mark is a Jewish man. So, Amy, you asked him for his thoughts about this new trend. Is it offensive? Is it all in good fun? What does it mean for Jewish folks to see Christians taking Jewish practices and traditions for themselves? Here is the interview.
I just want to start by apologizing on behalf of Christians everywhere for those of us who are apparently not satisfied with basically dominating the entire holiday landscape and want to appropriate everybody else's as well.
Oh, well, I don't, you know, I'm actually generally in favor of cultural appropriation. I think that's, you know, one of the nice things about living in a diverse country is that we do it whether we like it or not. So I'm not, I mean, certainly, you know, certainly plenty of Jews have Christmas trees, so who are we to talk? But I was surprised. I confess that I was very surprised to find out that a lot of Christians were celebrating Purim, because it's a holiday that has made a big comeback among American Jews, but it's not, you know, if you 50 years ago, you know, it was a distant third to Hanukkah and Passover, and it's still, you know, if you're among secular but vaguely affiliated Jews, it's still, you know, pretty peripheral, as opposed to in Israel, where it really is the Israeli Halloween. I mean, that's when kids dress up in costumes. So
for like an entire week, at least is what we're hearing from our Israeli cousins, is that kids buy, you know, 4 or 5 costumes and dress up every day in a different costume.
Well, that's news to me. I was actually in Israel last year for Purim, and I definitely saw, you know, there's a debt. I mean, the night of, the 24 hours of, beginning the night of Purim when they have the Megillah reading, when you're commanded to go listen to the story being read, and then there's often a Purim party, a carnival, a festival the next day where there's a Purim spiel, where there's a play, and you would go to that in costume. And historically, the tradition was more that you would dress up as one of the characters from the Megillah, from Megillat Esther, from the biblical story. So you'd be Mordechai or Haman or Vashti or Esther. And nowadays, both here and in Israel, it's more Halloween-y in that you can go as, you
Spider-Man.
Know, a ninja or,
right.
Yeah, I mean, you can go as Spider-Man, you can go as, you know, Elsa from Frozen. So it has, in that sense, there's been an appropriation of the American Halloween tradition of just dressing up as whatever the heck you want. But in Israel, it really is their version of Halloween. It's the time when you get to make merry in costume. And in American Orthodox communities, it's often the case that Halloween is somewhat controversial, is seen as a pagan or Gentile holiday, whereas Purim obviously is kosher. And then you have my kids who do Halloween and then also do Purim. So they have a couple times a year to dress up and make merry.
They get twice the fun. Yeah, it's not just in Orthodox communities here. Our kids, our daughter went to the JCC, and I know Halloween is definitely not celebrated because it's considered, as its roots are, a Christian holiday. And so Purim was definitely the time for kids to dress up. What kind of caught my eye when I was reading some of these church websites about their Purim festivals is they also kind of portrayed it as the one time of the year to have a fun festival and to dress up, which makes me wonder if they're doing what I was familiar with as a kid, which is discouraging people from celebrating Halloween, because far from seeing it as a Christian holiday, a lot of conservative evangelical churches see it as pagan and don't want to encourage.
Right. So, you know, if you look at the church in St. Paul that's celebrated at Calvary Chapel, mm-hmm. I mean, this is really interesting, where they say, you know, dress up as your favorite person from the Bible or as another historical person, whether it be a superhero, an animal, or a cartoon character, but please, nothing scary or devilish. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, you know, what's really funny about that is nothing is scarier than a character like Haman from the Purim story, right? who of course wants to murder all the Jews. So, you know, from a Jewish point of view, we'd far prefer that people dress up as some sort of, I mean, we'd far prefer to encounter some, you know, devil in a red outfit with a trident than an actual real life Haman. People do dress up as Haman. It is not the tradition that we don't dress up as scary things, mm-hmm. but we dress up as someone scary from the actual story. So that sort of evangelical touchiness about devilish characters strikes me as a little bit silly.
Yeah. The celebration of Purim also kind of strikes me as quite different from the equally problematic celebration of Passover in some Christian churches, which I'd like to also get to, in that it is specifically and only a story about the Jewish people. There's not even a mention of God in the story of Esther, if I'm correct.
That's right. That's right. It's the one. It's the one canonical Hebrew Bible text that has no mention of God at all. I mean, it really is an episode from Jewish history in which the Jews were quite, you know, fortunately, by the skin of their teeth, saved from not worldwide obliteration, but obliteration in the lands of Persia. Mm-hmm. And it's curious to me that Christians would want to celebrate it. You know, as I said, I'm a very difficult person to offend, and I generally am gratified by any interest in Jewish culture. I think that if people are really interested in the Jewish relationship to Purim, they should ask Jews about our relationship to Purim, and they, you know, plenty of Jews are happy to talk to Gentiles, to non-Jews, about our various holidays and our various traditions. I think what can be somewhat dislocating or a little disturbing about Christian or non-Jewish appropriations of Jewish customs is that they're often done poorly. They're often the Hebrew is often badly mispronounced. The holiday is often taken out of historical context. So here, for example, I can't even begin to fathom how they talk about this as having Christian resonance, because as you point out, there is no Christian resonance in it's a pre-Christian era. There's no mention of God. And I'm not aware of anyone kind of identifying, you know, New Testament typology from the book of Esther. So it strikes me as a little bit strange. And again, totally decontextualized from the way the Jews treat the holiday, which is about the salvation of Jews. So if Christians are going to use Purim as in any way instructive, one should think about contextualizing it in the history of anti-Semitism and the history of of Judeopathy, which is not my sense of how these churches are doing it.
Right. Well, and it seems to me that there is also a difference between attending, say, a Purim party at your local JCC, or we've got a free synagogue down the street that kind of offers a Purim party open for all, and holding a Purim party for the implied invitation is for Christians only at a church. Those are two, I would think, very different things, even given your more liberal view of appropriation.
Absolutely. I mean, I again, if it's about understanding Jewish culture, there are always, if you're in an area with any Jewish population, there are always Purim parties around to attend. And by the way, you know, they are pretty non-religious parties. Again, so Erev of Purim, the night of Purim, you will hear the Megillah being read, and you will often hear it being read again on the day of Purim. You know, Jewish holidays start the night before. But the Purim party is a pretty irreverent and, in fact, heretical affair. I mean, the tradition of the Purim spiel, first of all, the tradition is you get so drunk that you can't recognize the name of Haman. So I surely hope that nobody is having alcohol-free or teetotaling Purim parties, which really would be heretical. Would really disrespect the Jewish tradition. We absolutely insist that people get obliterated on Purim. And then the second thing is that the Purim spiel is a burlesque, is a mocking reconceptualization of the Purim story, in which people will often, you know, men will be dressed in drag, and people, it's often very bawdy and very sexual, and often very violent and graphic in all sorts of ways. So, you know, if you want to do it right, do it right. My experience with evangelical and especially fundamentalist Christian churches is that they're not the kind of places that would do this sort of thing right, which means they're fundamentally misunderstanding the tradition, because the theological import of Purim is we nearly got killed, we didn't get killed, Esther was able to save us, and then we killed a lot of the Gentiles who were trying to get us, right? We hanged Haman and all of his sons, and then we got really, really drunk to celebrate our triumph. Mm-hmm. So it is a theologically problematic text, insofar as most of us don't raise our children these days to think in terms of vengeance. Mm-hmm. And it's also a often profane and ribald ritual. So, you know, if you're going to do it right, you have to take all of that yichus, all of that heritage into account.
That is such a great point there, and I'm so glad that you could kind of explicate all of that for us. I did, before I let you go, want to get into what is, I think, at play here is the motivation for a lot of Christians, which is the somewhat problematic idea of their spiritual heritage as being rooted in the Jewish experience. And this is something we hear a lot from churches about why they might, say on Maundy Thursday, hold a Seder, because it's their understanding that that is what the Last Supper was.
Sure. I mean, I think, look, obviously it's the case that Christians have a vexed relationship with the Jewish heritage, and different Christian traditions have negotiated this in different ways. Obviously, a lot of churches that you might describe as more liberal, if that's a fair way to talk about it, want to draw fences around the Jewish portion of their heritage and respect it and say, you know, we honor it and we want it to continue as a living proof of our patrimony, and we want it to, you know, we want Jews to continue and we want Judaism to continue. And so then, there's often in that line of thinking a kind of respect for the Jewish rituals as their own thing that should be witnessed or learned from and that should persist, but that shouldn't be appropriated or remade into Christian forms. I think, interestingly, the Christian churches that are often more interested in performing our rituals are the ones that ultimately want Jews to become Christians. So they're looking to kind of devour the rituals. They want them to live on as part of a kind of early church persistence or atavism in Christian life, but they don't want actual Jews to persist because the ideal is for Jews to become Christians. So that can feel a little bit icky, to coin a theological term. And, you know, I mean, that sort of supersessionist ideology is always ahistorical. It always, and it's very, very, you know, it's fickle and it picks and chooses in really cynical ways. So, you know, these are people who want to celebrate a Passover Seder because they believe that Jesus did, but they don't want to keep kosher. They don't want to actually, you know, they don't mind if the Seder involves foods that Jesus or other first century Jews would not, or some first century Jews would not have eaten. And the, you know, there is a very strong template for what a religious Jewish life looks like, and you can find it in, you know, in a different form today, obviously, but you can find it among Torah observant Orthodox Jews. And that lifestyle doesn't tend to interest these Christians very much. So, I mean, I'm always, you know, an analogy, for example, something I always think about is when I talk to evangelical Christians about fasting, because that, you know, has a vogue in evangelical churches, where the church will have a daily fast or a week-long fast, or I once reported on a megachurch that claimed to be having a month of fasting, right? And they will often point to Old Testament examples of fast days. You know, Judaism actually has several fast days. It's not just Yom Kippur, but there are other fast days as well. There's several other fast days in our calendar. And then if you dig a little deeper, you find out that what the Christians mean by fasting is often only eating light meals. Or there was the megachurch pastor I knew in Florida who was going, his fasting for him was a juice fast, which was he would have smoothies, but no solid food. You know, that is not fasting. I mean, that is not in biblical fasting. Fasting was fasting, and it involves, in the Jewish tradition, not eating or drinking for 25 hours. Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting how deeply unserious some of these Christians can be about what the actual Jewish traditions are.
Yeah, as you point out, a lot of this is prevalent on the right in churches that would like to see themselves as the replacement for the Jewish tradition and ultimately bring Jews under the Christian umbrella. As far as Seders, I will say I've been observing them more and more as well in liberal churches that I think feel like it's something radical for them to do and maybe a pushback against anti-Semitism, in fact, to try to point out to other Christians, hey, these parts of our tradition maybe originally had their roots in Jewish traditions, so this is something that we need to respect. And here, I am kind of calling myself out. My husband is Jewish, but not at all practicing. And, you know, I'm a practicing Christian. I've got my divinity school education. So for years, I like to think that I was much better informed about, say, the Passover story than he was. And it's taken me longer than I would like to admit to realize that it is not my story at all. And it's why I always feel a bit discomforted at Passover Seders, even though I feel like I'm intimately acquainted with the story of Moses and the Israelites fleeing Egypt. But it's not my story. It's the story of a people. And as one much as I want to see myself as part of it, I'm really not.
I mean, I think that's very shrewd and that's good to hear you say. I would add two things. One is that it's always interesting to me and I think very telling what parts of the Jewish tradition even liberal Christians want to explore. So, for example, it's nice that people want to explore our holidays, including Passover, which is a great holiday, really a great holiday. You know, to have a communal meal where you talk about history and liberation and literature is obviously an extraordinary thing. On the other hand, it's also interesting to me how seldom, and there are huge exceptions to this, I want to be clear, there are many exceptions to this, but how seldom a lot of churchgoers I know want to explore the somewhat more demanding aspects of our tradition. So, for example, you know, there really is no very strong movement back towards Sabbath observance among Christians. And I mean, there are pockets of it. There are people who claim to be Sabbatarian, and there are people who try to set aside Sunday as a holier day. But there's been really nary a squeak in the entire country as our blue laws have disappeared, as businesses have started opening on Sundays, mm-hmm. as Sunday has become just another day of commercialism. And I grew up in Massachusetts where you couldn't go shopping on Sundays. Stuff was closed. And I'm Jewish, of course, so Sunday wouldn't be my day off. But it was beautiful. It was wonderful. And the Christians have entirely let that aspect of the patrimony, which you as Christians had held to in very strong ways for centuries, slip away. And, you know, one reason that people aren't so interested in that is because it's hard. You know, saying we're not going to work on Sunday, or we're not going to check email, or something, we're going to do something to sanctify a whole day, is hard. So traditional Christians, observant Christians, you know, serious Christians go to church, and that's important to them, but then they go to Denny's and then the mall, and then watch football. And it's, you know, I always think the best things we have going for us are things like setting aside a day for family and not technology or money. And mm-hmm. it's very hard to get Christians interested in that. So I always want to say it's nice that you're interested in Pesach or Purim, but we've got better stuff too, and stuff that will really reshape your lives. The second thing I would say, and with regard to, I guess, both Passover and Purim, is that to me, when conservative communities look at it, they kind of want to devour it and cannibalize it and make it part of a supersessionist Christianity that eradicates the need for Judaism or for the ongoing life of the Jewish people. A lot of liberal Christians similarly want to set aside this valorization of the historical exodus or the historical salvation of the Jews as this thing that is terrific in principle, but they, of course, have their own difficulties in connecting it to contemporary Israel, which is understandable because contemporary Israel is a very fraught and in some ways, conflicted state, of which I have many criticisms, and I think any thoughtful person should. That said, to my mind, if liberal Christians are having Passover seders or then Purim parties and talking about how wonderful it was that the Jewish people survived, they have to take a real stake in the survival of the Jewish people today, half of whom live in Israel. You know, like people who are living there. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, half of my community, half of the people whom I consider part of the extended family of Judaism, that's where they live. And so, you know, the liberal Christian narrative, which is one in which Jews are always terrific in scripture, but then are somewhat distasteful or vexing in contemporary life, is something that I think more deeply about.
Absolutely. Well, I'm so glad that you could come on to talk to us about this, to explain what a lot of folks are maybe not thinking through. And, you know, I like your bottom line of, appropriation is not necessarily always a bad thing, but you need to be more mindful of what it means and what the entire context and history are behind them.
And I think also you have to, if you want to know the holiday, you want to know the people celebrating the holiday. Mm-hmm. And I'm always amazed, and this is true of conservative Christians, but also some of the left-wing Christians I know, of how little interest they take in contemporary actual Jews, that their community is a community of evangelical Christians or fundamentalist Christians, or it's a community of, you know, liberal Presbyterians or fellow Congregationalists or Episcopalians. And then you say, well, what do your Jewish friends think of this? And pause, and well, maybe they know one or two Jews, or they have Jewish friends, but the Jewish friends they have are entirely secular and don't really challenge them or deepen their thinking on these questions. Mm-hmm. And, if you want to know Purim, talk to people who celebrate Purim within the Jewish context. They're not hard to find.
Excellent point. Well, Mark, I know that on your podcast, Unorthodox, you usually have a Gentile of the Week. I hope it's okay if we designate you the Jew of the Week.
Always happy to be anyone's Jew of the Week. Absolutely.
We'll have to make that a more regular segment, but thanks so much.
That would be great. All right. Well, thanks for having me on. Good luck.
So first of all, Amy, let's debrief this interview because there's so much here. There's so much to unpack. Mark is, wow, what a brilliant dude, number one. He's just so great, so easy to listen to, so funny. Like, I found myself laughing a couple times. There are so many things that he said here that I really, really resonated with. One of the ones that he said, I think he was talking about Purim specifically. And he was saying that, like, it's very, very troubling to see Christians take a kind of historical story of Jewish liberation that really has not a lot of theological context because God's name is not mentioned throughout the entirety of the story, and pluck that narrative out and this celebration out that is really kind of like a purely Jewish tradition and kind of plop it into a, you know, Christian context and trying to like extrapolate some meaning within a Christian narrative, and him kind of talking about like, yeah, that's kind of troubling to me. I found that really enlightening, and it kind of affirmed what I already think, frankly, that a lot of this stuff is really deeply problematic. I think Mark was a lot nicer in how he described it. He was very diplomatic and very kind.
Right, which is one reason we wanted to add our own discussion afterwards so that we can be sure to say, Christians, do not do this.
Stop it.
I was reminded of what is really a new entry in the canon of classic literature that you may or may not be familiar with, which is Dragons Love Tacos. We love this book so much. And there's a part in it where the dragons are eating tacos, unaware that there is spicy salsa in it. And the boy has to tell them, dragons, do not eat those tacos. And that's how I feel about this. Like, Christians, do not hold those Purim parties.
Unless you're going to get wasted. Do it right or don't do it. That's what I say.
And you're co-hosting with the synagogue or some other Jewish organization.
Right. Like, right.
There's no such thing as a Christian Purim party.
That's right. And that was one of the things that I loved about what he said in the interview with that he had with you, was saying that if you want to celebrate the like Jewishness or the kind of shared history within, you know, the context of the Jewish culture and kind of the Christian crossover, if you want to call it that, do it with Jewish people. Like, let them, you know what I mean? Like, go talk to your Jewish friends about why they love Purim. Go talk to your Jewish friends about why they celebrate Passover and have a Seder. And, like, let them be the driver of that conversation rather than, like, taking their tradition, making it your own and placing it within the majority narrative. Like, that sucks. That just kind of sucks. And I'm happy to say that sucks. He would not say that. He was very kind. But it was such a good interview.
And it ignores the fact that that story is about an oppressed minority people.
Right.
And by taking their story and making it your own, you are, in some ways, further oppressing a still minority people.
A still oppressed people.
Yes, the blinders that it takes to do that. Just, and here I should also say, many, many people are well-intentioned. They are when they do this, and especially with the Seders, and we will closer to Passover and Easter go a little more in depth with this. And as I told Mark, like, I fault myself in this as well. And part of it comes out of my deep desire to make our interfaith family work. And one of the ways I wanted to do that was to be able to hold up this narrative of a shared history. But I am ashamed of how many years it took me to really come to this realization. Every year, for reasons we do not have to completely get into, Passover is just a really tough holiday for me. And one of the reasons is, I have finally realized, it is not a shared story. Yes, it's in my Bible, and yes, it's in the Torah, and in the Jewish tradition through Passover and Seders. But I am not part of the community that is being celebrated in that. It's part of my religious history, but that is not the same as me being part of that community, because now I am part of the majority Christian community. I do not get to claim a space in the Jewish tribe. I just do not.
Yeah. Like, one of the things that I have been questioning as I've seen this come up, I have seen several of my acquaintances and colleagues have Purim parties. I have, in my less knowledgeable years and less aware years, I had attended a Christian Seder not knowing any different. You know, with all of the good intentions, right? Of going like, no, like, we have the shared history. We want to acknowledge and respect and, you know, hold up kind of this like shared history, this shared narrative. But that narrative sharply divides. Like, there, it does diverge quite significantly. And, oh man, I look back on some of that stuff that I did, and it makes me embarrassed, if I'm honest. But the thing that I keep going back to, and just to piggyback on what you were saying, is that, like, I'm not a part of those people. Like, those are not my people. That is not my narrative. That is not my story. That is not the story of my people. Like, the story of Passover, the story of Purim is so deeply meaningful and contextualized for the Jewish people, because not only do they have a long history of oppression, not just in the Torah, but well beyond. Like, obviously, you just look at world history, like, the Jewish people continued to be oppressed, continued to need liberation. And that narrative continues today. I mean, just last week, we talked about the rise of anti-Semitic attacks in this country, and how the Jewish people are still an oppressed and marginalized people. And so these traditions, these narratives still have a very deep, rich meaning that is very tangible to people here in 2018, not just back in the time of Jesus. And that is not my story. Like, I do not get to lay claim to that story as a white American evangelical Christian. It just makes me embarrassed to think about the ways that I co-opted it in the past. But
yeah, I mean, you know, it's a beautiful tradition.
It is. It's so rich and lovely.
I'm interested to see how different my experience will be this year. I'm going to try to come at it, which is hard for me because it's in our home. And we're trying to raise our children to understand it as participants themselves. But this was one of the things that just, like, made my stomach hurt before we had children, when I thought about sitting at the Passover table and being the outsider and watching the rest of my family participate in traditions that I couldn't. And because I know so much about it, I want to jump in. And we did hold a couple of seders. Our most successful one, I thought, was co-led by me and Noam. And we had Christian friends come and Jewish friends come. And it was a really lovely mix, because a lot of our Jewish friends don't necessarily know a lot of their own history. So, you know, there was kind of a similar learning curve around the table. But, you know, I don't know how this will change, because obviously it's different when there are family dynamics and your children involved, and it's not it is somewhat similar. No, I'm worried in the same vein about watching me go off with the kids to go to church on Sundays. And to be quite honest, he enjoys having the time to sleep in on Sundays. So that is not so much of a problem. But, maybe I should let him come on at some point and speak for himself. But the extent to which our little buddy is all about Jesus and all about the baby Jesus and just talks about God and Jesus in particular, that's tough because that's not part of his tradition either. So, you know, these are things that we navigate as a family, but they are things that Christians also need to be sensitive to and navigate as fellow children of God who want their own beliefs respected and need to be willing to show the decency and respect to other traditions as well.
Yeah. And you and I talked about this a little bit before we started recording about how there's kind of a difference, like that Christian holidays get appropriated in weird cultural ways, like, you know, the consumerism of Christmas, for example. Like, there's all these different cultural norms that surround Christmas that have nothing to do with the actual celebration of the birth of Jesus, which we talked about at length in the War on Christmas episode. But you were saying, like, this, there's nothing similar in the Jewish tradition. That Passover is Passover. There isn't like a weird cultural, like a secondary narrative to Passover, in the way that there is with like Christmas here or with Easter, frankly, you know, the Easter bunny. Where did that come from anyway? Cadbury mini eggs are the bomb, but there's not that additional framing within the Jewish culture like there is with Christianity. And so Purim and Passover have, for all intents and purposes, the original intent and meaning of those holidays has been intact. It is what it is. And it hasn't been co-opted by consumerism or any of this other stuff. And my fear, especially being a Christian, the dominant narrative in the religious American landscape, is that the more we take out the Jewish tradition of either Purim or Seder, Passover, is the more we take out those traditions out of their purely Jewish context and place them to suit our own narrative and to place it in a framework in which it was never meant to fit, the more the original intention and the more the original meaning of that traditional practice will start to disappear, because we are the majority and the Jewish culture is the minority. And so we don't have the same fear, right? That like somehow if someone else practices Christmas that isn't Christian, that like Christmas is all of a sudden going to go away, or the meaning of Christmas is somehow going to lose its meaning. We don't have that same fear because we're Christians in America. But if you're a Jewish person in America and your story and your tradition is being lifted out of that context and placed into the majority context, the Christian context where it was never meant to fit, there is that fear of like, oh, this could go away. Like this could slowly be pushed out and glossed over and made into something that it was never intended to be. I really worry about that. I worry about that for my Jewish friends and neighbors as more and more Christian communities start to, you know, engage in some of these things. I don't know.
So to wrap up our show, maybe some music, maybe something else. Nish, what do you have for us?
What I have for you is that Homeland is back.
Oh, no.
There's really nothing else. I mean, that, you know, I'm not super excited about it when I'm like, well, there's really nothing else on. Actually, so far this season, it's been really good. Took a deep dive there for a little while that it just wasn't very good. But so far, this season's been better.
Better is not a stellar recommendation.
I know. I'm sorry. But the storyline has been more interesting. It's definitely more timely, given the current state of affairs in our country and politics. It's definitely a riff on what's happening, for sure. Rest assured, lest you think that Carrie Matheson doesn't cry in every episode anymore. That is not true. She definitely cries in almost every episode still. But we are back to watching Homeland. So that is probably that's my first thing, is that we're back to watching Homeland. I can't quit it. I can't quit it, Amy. I'm just stuck in the story now. Another Showtime. Yeah, I will allow it this time. Another Showtime show is starting up here in a couple weeks. Billions. Did you ever watch Billions?
No, I like a lot of the actors on it, but it has not found a place in my lineup.
Damian Lewis, Paul Giamatti. Great show about, you know, venture capital, hedge fund. I don't know. I don't understand the terms. Noam could educate us, I'm sure. But yeah, so that comes back in a couple of weeks. But I have to say, for music, the singer, if you have Apple Music, a subscription to Apple Music, the singer-songwriter radio station has been my jam this week. They have been crushing it. And I have to say, I was a little annoyed when we decided to make the switch to Apple Music from Spotify, because Spotify just kills it on the playlists. The Spotify playlists are amazing. And I thought that Apple Music was a little lacking. And I have found the singer-songwriter radio station on Apple Music. So if you're an Apple Music family or person like we are, it is it's a really good station. They play really good stuff. So that's my recommendation this week. What about you?
What about me? Well, Nish, as you know, it is March.
Indeed.
And March means
St. Paddy's Day.
March Madness.
Oh, and March Madness.
And I don't know if you were paying attention this weekend, but the Michigan Wolverines came back. Nobody thought that they would do it again, but they have repeated as Big Ten champion, and they are now ranked in the top 10 going into the tournament. Infuses my life with meaning.
Good for you. That's a big statement.
And I know that you are a Duke fan, so we will perhaps need to end the podcast here. It's been a good run.
I was going to say Duke beat... I mean, you know what? All I care about is that Duke beat Carolina. Duke beat Carolina.
But my recommendation, in addition to recommending everybody cheer for the Michigan Wolverines, because we have an awesome... is a piece that ran on NPR this weekend. It was on Weekend Edition on Sunday about, and I can't believe I didn't even know this existed before, but a camping option in England, basically a church that is no longer used for services. There are a number of old churches, and in this one, the NPR correspondent took his family to an 18th century church outside of Oxford, and they camped inside the church and played an old organ, and it's, let me do this, but they call it champing. It's not glamping. So that is now one of my life's goals, is to go champing.
I'll join you.
We can plan a trip to England and go champing.
I mean, you know how I feel about England, so sign me up. Yes. Take my money. That's what I have to say.
We were
that
meant
sounds
to live
amazing
there.
What? Like, you, like, sleep in the pews or something? How does that work?
Yep, you can sleep in the balcony. You just bring your sleeping bag and maybe a blow-up mattress, because those floors are hard.
Oh, dude, yeah, so and, hard. I mean, you know, stone.
Wear some sweaters, because it's cold. But
little drafty in an 18th century church. Who knew?
It's the idea of it, really.
Just don't appeal. Do it in the winter. That's amazing. That would be so fun.
So that's so my recommendation. Fun. Go champing.
Go champing. I love it. Okay, that is all for this week's episode. Thank you so much for joining us. Impolite Company is produced every week by Constantine Hios. If you've enjoyed our conversation, please, please, please rate us on iTunes. It's the very best way to let other people know about us. And if you'd like to support the show, check out our Patreon page.
and consider supporting us financially so that we can continue to expand these conversations. The link is in the description on your favorite podcast player. And as always, we will post the show notes on our website. Until next week, have fun storming the castle, kids.